Ani, and welcome to Bomsida, an Aboriginal news magazine program that features news, current affairs, a focus on community and culture, spotlights on entertainment and great tunes, and every flavor from Aboriginal artists. I'm your host, Jennifer Ashwasagay. The Aboriginal Front Door Society is one of 15 groups boycotting the second phase of the Missing Women Commission of Inquiry in BC. A First Nation in Northern Ontario wants its voice to be heard in the mining industry in their territory. Former students of two Indian residential schools are encouraged to file applications for common experience payments after an appeals court ruling. The only Aboriginal homeless shelter in Montreal is struggling to keep its doors open. Elsewhere, the new Child and Family Advocate Certificate Program is getting the thumbs up from the prior Child and Youth Services Ministry Aboriginal Affairs Advisor. All these stories plus great tunes from Aboriginal artists all coming your way right after the news. International Aboriginal News. The federal government has axed all funding to the National Aboriginal Health Organization. The organization has been in operation over the past 12 years, with its core funding of $4.9 million coming from the federal government. NAHO has produced over 200 health reports, video footage, and audio tapes of Aboriginal elders' Indigenous knowledge, the Journal of Aboriginal Health, and other specialized health reporting for Aboriginal peoples. The organization will now be negotiating with universities and health research institutions to take over its intellectual holdings. NAHO will close its doors June 30th this year. Meanwhile, the Globe and Mail reports the organization lost support from Aboriginal organizations before the funding cuts were announced. The Globe reports three of NAHO's founding members, the Assembly of First Nations, Inuit Tapirikanatami, and the Métis National Council, advised the minister that they were pulling out of NAHO and wanted the funds allocated to their individual centers. According to the Winnipeg Free Press, Pegwa's First Nation Chief and Council in Manitoba paid themselves thousands of dollars earmarked for flood compensation, and more money was funneled to private consultants and make work projects. An Ottawa Independent Management Review and auditing firm raised red flags. The review was ordered by Aboriginal Affairs and Northern Development to find out what happened to $10.5 million in federal flood compensation funding. The audit on Pegwa's was part of a larger audit on how federal emergency assistance was handled for the 2010-2011 flooding in the province. Meantime, the Winnipeg Free Press has also reported that residents of four First Nations in Manitoba are suing the province for nearly $1 billion. They say the province knowingly and recklessly caused the flooding to occur. The statement of claim was filed April 4th in Winnipeg by a London, Ontario law firm representing nine residents and an area fish plant. The statement of claim blames the Shellmouth Dam, the Portage Diversion, and Fairford River Water Control Structure for last spring's flooding. A statement of defense from the province has not yet been filed. 15 organizations have confirmed that they won't be participating in the second phase of the Missing Women Commission of Inquiry. The Aboriginal Front Door Society is one of the 15 organizations. Executive Director Mona Woodward says the inquiry is both racially and sexually discriminatory. She says community groups want to have an inquiry of their own.
We came up with the idea of an inquiry into the inquiry. And what we want to do is do our own community forums that will outline recommendations and give it to Wally Opal. Because the way the inquiry has gone, it's a total miscarriage of justice to the missing and murdered women. And it is not a fair and just system.
Woodward says Wally Opal is scrambling to legitimize his inquiry by trying to get people to participate in his forums. She adds the inquiry is losing credibility. Another First Nation has pulled out of the hearings into Enbridge's Northern Gateway Pipeline. Nuxalk First Nation of Bella Coola is the second First Nation to cancel its status as intervener. The Globe and Mail quotes Hereditary Chief Charlie Nelson that they pulled out because of the way a neighboring community had been treated. Nelson believes the federal government intends to approve the project and that new time limits only serve to further compromise the independence of the panel. Grand Chief Ed John of the First Nation Summit says although although there are still 46 First Nations with intervenor status, the current cancellation will provide further legal action against the project. Kitchenimaku Sibininawag Chief Donnie Morris is inviting Ontario Northern Development and Mines Minister Rick Bartolucci for a meeting. The chief wants to hammer out issues surrounding mining in the territory. The Ontario government bought God Lake's resources claims on KI traditional land just a few weeks ago. KI chief and councillors were happy with that decision. Staying in Northern Ontario, Wattawapiskat First Nation is not backing down from its lawsuit against the federal government. The Canadian Press reports the First Nation won't be dropping its legal action over the appointment of a third-party manager to handle the band's finances. That's despite the government's move to withdraw the third-party manager. The band's media release says it wants the courts to refute Prime Minister Stephen Harper's suggestion that the band mismanaged federal funds in the face of a housing crisis. A hearing has been set for April 24th. Meanwhile, Attawapiskat has signed a Memorandum of Understanding with Bold Ventures Incorporated. The company will conduct a follow-up drilling program in Attawapiskat's traditional territory, which is part of the Ring of Fire. The Ring of Fire is known for its rich chromite deposits. Former students of two Indian residential schools are encouraged to file applications for common experience payments after an appeals court ruling. Sturton Lake and Crystal Lake in Northern Ontario have been added to the list of residential schools. Susan Vella is the lawyer for Windigo First Nations Council and the Anishinaabe Nation. She says the court ruling is precedent-setting.
Last August of 2011, Anishinaabe Nation and the Windigo First Nations Council won an important victory before the Ontario Superior Court of Justice. Chief Justice Winkler ruled in our favor, adding Sterling Lake and Crystal Lake residential schools to the list of Indian residential schools under the settlement agreement that was reached. It was important for a couple of reasons. The first is this was the first decision in Canada, where First Nations was successful in having schools added to this settlement agreement, which would make the former students eligible to apply for compensation. And so this was a precedent-setting decision across the country. Canada then filed a notice of appeal, because in Canada's view, these two high schools do not meet the criteria set out in the settlement agreement for the definition of an Indian residential school. As part of that process, we attended on behalf of NAN and Windigo before the Court of Appeal to oppose Canada's request to have the declaration issued by the Chief Justice stayed, which means that it would be of no force or effect until the appeal was decided. We were successful in resisting that stay motion.
Since the motion was stayed, Vella says former students of the two schools are eligible to apply for compensation. Vella says they received word that Canada has abandoned its appeal. Nunatsiak News reports Nunavik's Makovic Corporation and other social service agencies in Montreal want to save a shelter for homeless Aboriginal people in the city. The shelter has been in existence downtown Montreal since 2004. However, it may have to shut its doors at the end of June if it can't find a new place to set up. The Montreal Health Authority owns the Aboriginal Projects of Quebec, or PAC, shelter. The agency has plans to tear down the existing building and build new space for its own offices. PAC Director Adrian Campbell says although they've known about this for 2 years, it's been a challenge to find a new building for the shelter.
The reality is that we're a homeless shelter for Aboriginal people, so nobody really wants that in the neighborhood. So oftentimes, for the past 2 years, even when we found places that might seem suitable for us, most of the time the answer was no right from the start. We couldn't even actually look at the place because the borough would tell us, forget it, there's no way that you can establish yourself in this neighborhood. So that's been probably one of the biggest problems, is the syndrome, what we call not in my backyard. Nobody wants the homeless shelter in their backyard.
Campbell says discontinuing services is not an option. The shelter has 28 beds for men and 9 for women, and about half of the shelter's 300 regular users are Inuit. The former Aboriginal advisor to the Ontario Ministry of Children and Youth Services is giving a new program the thumbs up. John Bokash says the First Nation Child Welfare Advocate Certificate Program is welcome news.
It's something that is part of what should be done right now. And it's one of these things that when you think about it, it's an initiative, something that that we've always had, but we've kind of let it go for a while, and we've had other levels of government take control of our children, and now we're trying to get it back, to take it back, which is exactly what we should be doing.
Bokash produced a report last year for the Ministry of Children and Youth Services on the state of Aboriginal child welfare in the province. A few of the key recommendations included First Nation jurisdiction over child welfare and implementing customary care practices. Wabuskang First Nation is located near Red Lake, Ontario, in the northern parts of the province, and its traditional territory is home to rich mining reserves. But the community has decided it can no longer sit quiet while companies and the Ontario government benefit from mining in the territory and concerns are ignored. Leslie Cameron, chief of Wabuskang First Nation, said they're tired of being ignored.
We're not happy a lot of the way they address them, and MNBM doesn't seem to hear us when we talk to them. It's like we're being pushed aside, you know, and not taken seriously. So, you know, this is kind of a first step to try to get our voices heard. You know, and we hope that, you know what I mean, that we will be taken seriously.
Cameron went to speak at the Ontario Prospectors Association's 2012 Northwestern Ontario Mines and Mineral Symposium in Thunder Bay earlier this month. And that's your National Aboriginal News.
Gotta quit the
That was Brock Stonefish with Pounding on My Soul. The Aboriginal Front Door Society is one of 15 groups boycotting the second phase of the Missing Women Commission of Inquiry. Executive Director Mona Woodward explains why her organization doesn't want to be part of the inquiry.
I think that the inquiry overall, and week by week, there is an overwhelming evidence of discrimination, racial and sexual, that has happened within their own staffing. And, you know, these are the people that are supposed to do a good job within the inquiry process. And the family members, as well as the community, have been meeting one time a week. And we've been talking about this in great length. And we came up with the idea of an inquiry into the inquiry. And what we want to do is do our own community forums that will outline recommendations and give it to Wally Opal. Hmm. Because the way the inquiry has gone is it's a total miscarriage of justice to the missing and murdered women. And there, it is not a fair and just system.
Why do you think that there's been a miscarriage of justice here?
Why do I think there's a miscarriage of justice? Because of the inquiry process, and it fails to recognize the racism and sexism that happened within the VPD, within the RCMP, and within the whole process. And it doesn't represent Aboriginal people's rights or perspective. And with the Robin Jarvis leaving, you know, it was overwhelmingly, blatantly clear that, you know, the inquiry does not represent Aboriginal people. It does not represent the missing and murdered women's families.
And so when do you think that you'll start your inquiry into the inquiry?
We have set a date yet, but we are looking into when and how we can do that. Aboriginal Front Door has done a lot of a lot of the work that we do is community driven, and when we were approached regarding the forums to Ms. Buckley, Melina Buckley, we consulted with the community and with our members, and they weren't keen on participating in the study piece. Wally Opal is scrambling to legitimize his inquiry, and that by sending people within this community to try to troll around to get people to participate in their forums is just an example of that. They're losing credibility. Plan is to take it to international law because, Canada does recognize the rights of Indigenous Aboriginal people. And I think that that is all going to happen, but not now. In the meantime, we want to be able to meet and talk more, because once the inquiry is over, that's when the real work happens, because there's still going to be, you know, abuse against women and abuse against Aboriginal women in particular.
Okay, so you probably know that the UN Committee on Racial Discrimination is going to be looking into missing and murdered Aboriginal women in Canada. And do you think that will help in part to address the issues that you're looking at in the inquiry?
I think that certainly it's in the forefront of national and international eyes, and that everybody is watching to see how Vancouver is going to be addressing the missing and murdered women across Canada within the inquiry.
Okay, and while this inquiry is going on and all the organizations have pulled out of it, how do you propose that the missing or murdered Aboriginal women's voices be heard in Vancouver?
That's the easy part. I think that as a grassroots frontline organization, we always are directed by the work for the people who we represent. We represent over 1,200 people access our programs and service, with the majority being women and children. And the fact is that they have a voice, and they tell us what needs to be done. We're in the process of working towards rebuilding a relationship with the Vancouver Police Department for Sister Watch. We're also involved on the grassroots level on any death that has happened. And women are still going missing throughout this process, and women are dying. We just had a death 2 weeks ago, and we had a community response. This community response was directed by the family and the people of this community, whereas we asked the VPD to help organize this community response, because what happens is that the frontline organizations end up doing victim services, support, and organizing to try to assist that family, where the victims, there's not enough victim service workers within this area, even though, you know, they announced all that money that was going to go to addressing, you know, violence against women, when nothing's really trickled down to, like, you know, we're in the trenches.
That was Mona Woodward, Executive Director at the Aboriginal Front Door Society in Vancouver. Former students of two Indian residential schools are encouraged now to file applications for common experience payments after an appeals court ruling. Susan Vella is the lawyer for Windigo First Nations Council and the Anishinaabeyaski Nation.
Last August of 2011, Anishinaabeyaski Nation and the Windigo First Nations Council won an important victory before the Ontario Superior Court of Justice. Chief Justice Winkler ruled in our favor, adding Sterling Lake and Crystal Lake residential schools to the list of Indian residential schools under the settlement agreement that was reached. It was important for a couple of reasons. The first is this was the first decision in Canada where First Nations was successful in having schools added to this settlement agreement, which would make the former students eligible to apply for compensation. And so this was a precedent-setting decision across the country. Canada then filed a notice of appeal, because in Canada's view, these two high schools do not meet the criteria set out in the settlement agreement for the definition of an Indian residential school. As part of that process, we attended on behalf of NAN and Windigo before the Court of Appeal to oppose Canada's request to have the declaration issued by the Chief Justice stayed, which means that it would be of no force or effect until the appeal was decided. We were successful in resisting that stay motion, and as a result, the former students are able to now make applications for the independent assessment process and the common experience payment with respect to their attendances at Sterling Lake and Crystal Lake High Schools. We also have just received word from Canada that they have decided to abandon their appeal. So now the appeal is gone, meaning that the Chief Justice's declaration that these are indeed Indian residential schools stand, and we're encouraging all former students to file their application.
And so what was the difference that the Canada was pointing out that didn't make these schools technically an Indian residential school in their eyes?
The Canada took the position that these were private schools operated by the Northern Youth Programs, which is a Mennonite-informed organization. They said that by the 1970s, when these schools were created, Indian Affairs had reversed its policy of having Indian residential schools, and were now closing down residential schools as opposed to opening new schools. And so basically they said these are private schools, it's a different funding relationship, Northern Youth Programs was in charge of these schools, we weren't in charge of these schools, and therefore they're not Indian residential schools. Our response was that these schools clearly were Indian residential schools. They were created to fill what was a gap in Indian Affairs education policy back in the 70s, namely that students were having a rough time transitioning into the urban high schools and having to stay in boarding homes. And so at the time, concerned parents thought that it would be more beneficial to have students closer to home, so to speak, in the context of a residential high school run by this Mennonite organization. At the end of the day, Canada entirely funded these schools. They exercised control over these schools because they defined the enrollment list. They created the enrollment list. They and Northern Youth Programs could only admit students to their schools which were on these lists. These were residential schools in that the students had to travel to the schools and live there full time. They got their education there, and it was a completely segregated school in the sense that it was only for Aboriginal students. So, you know, what was kind of unique about these schools compared to the other schools listed on the schedule is that these were the first two high schools that are added. All the other schools were basically kindergarten to grade 8 or 9. And so that's somewhat unique, but in the criteria set out in the agreement, there was no distinction with respect to high schools versus elementary schools. So so that was, you know, Canada's position and our response to it.
That was Susan Vella, lawyer for Windigo First Nations Council and the Anishinaabe Nation. Now here's Eagle and Hawk with What If We Could.
Spoken, what if I knew hearts in two?
former Aboriginal advisor to the Ontario Ministry of Children and Youth Services, is giving a new program the thumbs up. John Bokash says the First Nation Child Welfare Advocate Certificate Program is welcome news.
Well, I think it's a wonderful program and ahead of its time. Well, actually, I should say not ahead of its time. It's something that is part of what should be done right now, and it's one of these things that when you think about it, it's an initiative, something that we've always had, but we've kind of let it go for a while, and we've had other levels of government take control of our children, and now we're trying to get it back, to take it back, which is exactly what we should be doing.
So I know you had prepared a report last year for the Ministry of Youth and Children, and do you know where that report sits right now with them?
I have had some discussion briefly with the regional chief, Angus Toulouse, and he has brought forward a number of times with the Minister of Children and Family Services that the report should be acted upon. The Minister of Aboriginal Affairs has mentioned a couple of times that she'd like to speak further with me about the report and how to act on some of the recommendations. But I think with the election that occurred last fall and with the budget that just occurred a little while ago, there were some items put on the back burner, and I think my report was one of those items put on the back burner, and I'm hoping that our political leaders can move it forward a little bit.
And can you remind us about a few of the top recommendations that you had and why they would be really important to implement?
Well, I think some of the aspects of the recommendations were items that everybody knows about that works with child and family services and works with children. But it really comes down to looking after our own children ourselves, and to be able to take control, to be involved with the care of the children, and where there are children in dangerous situations, that we have our own organizations that can go in and help, that we should be looking at different ways of setting up foster care, that traditional methods for adoption should be used, that traditional customary care should be a integral part of all children's aid services, that we should have more Aboriginal people on the boards of children's aids across the province, whether or not they primarily have Native people as their clients or not, that there should be a traditional aspect all the way around. And that's only a few of the recommendations I had. I think there were 18 recommendations in total.
And so did your role end as an Aboriginal advisor to the Ministry of Youth and Child Services end when your report was completed?
I did spend just a few more weeks to assist in the publishing of it, and also to make some various talks around the province concerning the report. And my role as Aboriginal advisor ended in July, and the report was released in April of last year. And one of my recommendations as well was that there be a continuing position of Aboriginal advisor, and that they should really find somebody that has extensive child and family experience, and that this person could act as a liaison and an advisor for the minister and for First Nations throughout the province. So that was also a main recommendation.
That was John Bokash, former Aboriginal advisor to the Ontario Ministry of Children and Youth Services. Kalbiskang First Nation is a small community in northern Ontario and has been struggling to have its voice heard in the mining industry. Chief Leslie Cameron spoke with Bomsida on his way to a mining symposium in Thunder Bay earlier this month.
We're very small. We're a small First Nation.
we have a population of, I don't even think it's 300 yet, you know, and we've always been overlooked, you know, by things that are going on, and now with so much, especially with mining going on in the Red Lake District, you know, we figured that it's time to be noticed. It's time to be taken seriously, you know, and we met with a few companies, and they asked us our concerns, and in some ways, I guess they tried to address them. But we were not happy with a lot of the way they addressed them, and MNBM doesn't seem to hear us when we talk to them. It's like we're being pushed aside, you know, and not taking seriously. So, you know, this is kind of a first step to try to get our voices heard, you know, and we hope that, you know what I mean, that we will be taken seriously. But these are my community's concerns. We just finished with our chief and council and our resource committee when you called earlier, and now I'm sitting in the car. We're all heading back home. Thunder Bay is a five-hour drive for us.
And so you said you're not, you feel you're not being taken seriously in your territory. And so how have your concerns been taken with companies and government? Like, what have they said to you or what?
I don't want to go too much into a company because we still are talking. But with the ministry, they asked us for our concerns and they asked us how we want to be dealt with. So we tell them, you know. And then they tell us, well, we can't do those things for you. So we're wondering, you know, why ask us? Or what are you here for? Everything seems to be, everything sides with the company. So, and we're not being heard. Treaty B has a treaty, a soft treaty with the government. So the starters, they should start looking at stuff like that. You know, and we do have resource sharing and things in our treaty, you know, but nobody wants to look at that stuff.
And so what kind of industry activities have been happening in your territory?
I'll answer the ones that haven't and be shorter. Well, there's always been forestry. I grew up in the Red Lake area. We're about 100 kilometers away from Red Lake. Wabaskang First Nation is the closest First Nation to the actual township of Golden. Everything that goes on in Red Lake is shipped right by Wabaskang. We're the only highway in, the only highway out. So there's a lot of things going on. But even with the internet, fiber optics, stuff like that, we go right by our front door, but nobody seems to take what we're requesting seriously. And I don't know if it's because we're too small, you know, but we may be small, but we are. We're gonna start making noise, and we're gonna be heard.
All right. And so, you attended the Ontario Prospectors Association Northwestern Ontario Mines and Minerals Symposium this week in Thunder Bay. So, what happened there?
You know what? It's still going on. I'm heading there today. There's people that want to talk to me there, so I'm gonna head there for a while before I go home. Yesterday was the first day of it, and we were hoping to get our press release out a little bit earlier, but it didn't go out till Monday. So we handed it out there. You know, so we'll go see what kind of a response we'll get from over there.
That was Wabaskang First Nation Chief Leslie Cameron. Now here's Wanda Wilson with Fire.
Your pictures. Smoke was green from your letters. Road broken into more, but I was still with the father. Yeah.
One Aboriginal-specific homeless shelter in Montreal, and it's in trouble. The shelter needs to find a new home before the end of June. Adrienne Campbell is the director of Aboriginal Projects of Quebec.
Projects of Quebec is the only Aboriginal homeless shelter in Montreal for men and women. So it's a unique resource, which means it's an important one. We currently offer shelter services, so nighttime services. Hot meals, referrals, showers, laundry services, and we're also moving towards offering more daytime activities, morning activities. And because of those services, we receive approximately 40 people per night, so men and women, but mostly men. So there's definitely a need for those services that we offer. And unfortunately, the building that we're in right now is owned by CLSC, and they're being asked to leave their current location, which means that they may need to move back into where we are right now, the space that we occupy now. The problem is, we're sort of victims of a domino effect here. The problem is that we've known that they might want to recuperate the building. They made us aware of it. So for the past 2 years, we've been looking, along with many other partners. We've kept the CLSC in the loop. Everybody's been a concerted effort, basically, to find a new place for PAC. However, the reality is that we're a homeless shelter for Aboriginal people, so nobody really wants that in their neighborhood. So oftentimes, for the past 2 years, even when we found places that might seem suitable for us, most of the time the answer was no right from the start. We couldn't even actually look at the place because the borough would tell us, forget it, there's no way that you can establish yourself in this neighborhood. So that's been probably one of the biggest problems, is the syndrome, what we call not in my backyard. Nobody wants the homeless shelter in their backyard. So for 2 years, we've looked. Like I said, we had a lot of people around the table helping us, meeting with us regularly. So this was quite an effort that we did. And, at the end of those 2 years of looking, unfortunately, there was nothing. Either, a building cost, maybe $1.2 million, which obviously we don't have. We're a small nonprofit organization. But again, like I said, the main problem was the fact that, the location. A lot of suitable buildings were in, let's say, residential areas. So, we couldn't go there because the citizens didn't want us. So that's been the big problem. So right now, we're moving up on the deadline, which is June 30th. That's the end of the lease, and we still don't have a place. The City of Montreal currently pays the rent for us, but they made it clear that they will cease to do so as of July 1st. So even if we did renew a lease with the CLSC, let's say they gave us an extension of another 6 months or so, we still don't have money to pay the rent because we've never had to include that in our budget before. The City of Montreal had always kind of worked in partnership with PAC, you know, to make it possible for us to stay at that location. So the reality right now is as of July 1st, there's no other option to go anywhere else. And as well, the city will stop paying the rent. So either way, we have a problem. The CLSC has, you know, sort of stated that, okay, no, we're not going to put you guys out on the street. Don't worry. You know, so there's sort of been an acknowledgement that, you know, we can't close down the shelter. You know, we can't close down PAC. But nonetheless, that leaves us with still a great deal of uncertainty as to what's going to happen. In our opinion, it's much easier for a CLSC to find another location than for an Aboriginal homeless shelter to find another location, which is why we've been trying to ask the CLSC to give us a 5-year lease at our current location. We've received money, which is enough to renovate, not to purchase another location, but to renovate the one we're in. So, you know, for us, that seems the most logical and, well, almost the only option left. From what we can see. And the reason why we're asking for a 5-year lease is because we need stability. If we are to move in the future, we need enough time to actually consolidate our finances, consolidate our organization internally. And when I say consolidate our finances, I mean get core funding, do a lot more fundraising. Because, like I said, if we are to move out on our own, and if the city is to kind of, you know, cut the cord and no longer support us in the rent payments, we need to have enough time to be able to build up that financing on our own.
That was Adrienne Campbell, Director of Aboriginal Projects of Quebec. The shelter has been in existence since 2004 and has 28 beds for men and 9 for women. You've been listening to Bombsida with Jennifer Ashwasagay. Bombsida is an Aboriginal news magazine program which includes current affairs, arts and entertainment, and a cross-genre of music from Aboriginal artists. Bombsida means walking together in the Anishinaabe language. Music for the program is courtesy of Burnt Project One. If you have comments or story ideas, visit my website at bombsida.com. That's B-A-M-O-S-E-D-A. And thanks for listening to Bombsida.